and in your seating, if you have a Bible or a tablet or a phone, thank you, Janet. I'm going to be in John 13, if you want to turn there. Let me look at you. Look like a bunch of bank robbers. Okay, here we go. Jesus said, Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And he said it in the context of his disciples having a discussion again about issues of leadership. Keep that in mind. So there were a group of us on that Saturday morning. We made it finally to Scrambler's restaurant, eating our eggs and drinking our coffee. And we got talking about what just transpired in the last day and a half. We just got done giving away hundreds and hundreds of Christmas trees. And we were talking about the experience of giving the Christmas trees away. Experiences like, I just talked to somebody that came all the way from Erie, Pennsylvania. Or I just kept having this lady from Channel 8 News keep trying to put a microphone on my face, and I'm trying to take people to where they can find their Fraser fur. Or someone asked me, can I take two trees? Because my brother can't afford a tree either. Great stories. Great stories of serving. A number of years ago, Sue and I took a group of, let's call them young professionals, young adults who were very professional. We had a PhD from NASA. We had a medical doctor. We had a number of people like that. And we were headed to Milan, Italy, to basically serve in one of the churches there. And it was primarily to be a service of ministry, in the sense of we were going to lead a vacation Bible school and do a few things like that of pretty hands-on ministry. When we got there, however, the church had just purchased this sort of this dilapidated space within one of the apartment buildings in Milan. And we spent almost our entire time doing grunt work. I mean, tearing down pipes and painting, and the septic system was all a mess. And so it was the smelliest ministry I ever done in my life with this whole septic. You could smell it all over the place, and we did it. And yet when that group gets together again, and we have, we talk about how great it was when we got together and we did the septic work and how smelly it was and the painting on the wall and all of that. We turned the fellowship hall into a TJ Maxx. And we took clothing from the congregation and from others as well, but it had to be really good clothing, nothing you'd throw away. We wanted it to be nice stuff. And then we invited the more needy people in the community to come and have at it. And so they did, and they came, and it was crowded. And I remember there was this one young fellow. He was there with his mom, and she was showing him clothes, and he couldn't be bothered. And all of a sudden, he's standing next to me, and he's looking at something, and he spots a perfectly new LeBron James jersey. And he looks up at me with the biggest eyes, and he says, can I have that? Took it off the rack, and I said, it sure looks like your size. I think you can. He couldn't express enough thanks that he could actually have a LeBron James jersey. And I'll never forget the beaming face of that kid. There's something about serving, you know? There's something unforgettable about serving. There's something profound, meaningful. You want to do it again and again. Despite the cold, despite the smelly, despite the inconvenience, to get out of your comfort zone and actually see others where they are. There's something about that, you know? Serving is more than just random, is a spiritual discipline you love to talk about, like, wow, you fasted for 48 hours? Whoa. You were silent for 20 minutes? Sorry. It's more than that. There's a joy, there's a camaraderie, there's a depth to the spiritual discipline of service. In many ways, it's a manifestation of the kingdom of God right here and right now. We're in a series that we're calling Rhythms. And throughout this series of rhythms, we have been comparing the various spiritual rhythms or disciplines to the various exercises that get your body in shape. We are saying that the spiritual rhythms are important to get us in physical shape. And so if you're here for the first time, I apologize. If you're here and have been here for a while, I remind you of the rhythms that we've been looking at or the instructions that go along with them. And I ask you, how are you doing? And I ask it knowing, since we compare it to physical exercise, we started this almost at the beginning of the year. And I know that, you know, early in January, everybody joins CrossFit or Gold's Gym or whatever. And for 2 weeks, man, we're in it. We're pumping iron and we're doing all the stuff. And usually by Valentine's Day, we can't even spell the word gym. It's, what's that? And I know that. And I can't do that with this. You got to stay with it. And so I ask you, how you doing? We started the whole thing, and I called it our prayer for 2021 because I intend it to be your prayer for all year long. And if you still have that booklet, there might be some around, and we're going to put it on our website. It might still be there. I was so burnt out by the end of last year and so upside down. My prayer for 2021 has been, Lord, restore to me the joy of my salvation. I'm not quitting that prayer. How about you? Still praying your 2021 prayer? The week we did read the Bible, because there's 6 chapters in the book of Ephesians, and a number of you said, I'm reading Ephesians. You read through Ephesians, but don't quit. Go read the Gospel of John if you're not in something right now. Or pick a proverb. Pick the month of the day of the month that we're in. This is what, March 7th? Start with Proverbs 7 and go the rest of the month. But keep going. Keep going with all of those. Silence and solitude, it's huge. The discipline of fasting, try it, practice it. We will have a time in October, again, we will bring it up again, where we will have a day for men and one for women, where we will go for an entire day where we can practice silence and solitude. Be a part of it. You'll hear it again. Confess the mess. You got to confess. Confession of life and sin is part of the Christian life. It's part of the rhythms of life. And then last week, even the whole idea of simplicity, that less can be more in my life. Those are the disciplines that we've been looking at. And today we're completing the series. And as I say that, I also want to remind you, you never graduate from the school of spiritual formation. Just because we're completing the series doesn't mean, did that, boom, on to the next thing. Oh, no. Spiritual formation has got to be part of our lives, part of all of our lives. And today's rhythm is the rhythm of service. If all of those internal disciplines that we just looked at, Bible reading, praying, fasting, silence, if all of those internal rhythms are sort of like the exercises in the gym to get you ready, you know, the training, if all of those in a sense are to get ready for the game, then in many ways, the rhythm of service is the game. It is the game. Way back in the beginning, we said that ultimately the goal or the purpose of spiritual disciplines, the purpose is to bless others, to bless the city. To do all of these things is not just so that somehow internally I'm getting better and then it ends there. The purpose is to live a life that is beneficial to others, that is blessing others. That's the purpose. And so the game is actually serving. The goal, of course, is Christ-likeness. If you're like me, not infrequently, do you go through times of dryness? You pray, you read your Bible, you do the churchy stuff, and then you go through seasons where this is the Sahara Desert. This isn't working anymore. Your kids too, by the way. You wonder why your kids are sleeping through Bible story or whatever it is. Times of dryness are real. They're part of it. Let me connect some dots for you. When we make space, when we make time for God to work in our lives, as rhythms begin to work in us and get us in better spiritual shape, our hearts, our wills, our very bents begin to be developed toward servanthood. And now all of a sudden we're saying, oh, I get it. And there's no more dryness of the abstract because now it's the concrete. This is what we're doing. Or the medical student finally gets to go into the hospital and serve patients. That's how you get out of the dryness. The dryness is because your own room can get really, really dusty. But you take what's going on in your own room, of your heart, of your life, of your wherever, and you go. You open the window and you go and serve. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I'm not dry anymore. How we serve is a barometer of our spiritual health and our spiritual maturity. How you serve is a reflection of Christ in you. You're never more Christ-like than when you serve. When you serve from a transformed heart and a spirit that's filled with love. The Son of Man came to be served, came not to be served, but to serve. John chapter 13. Are you there? Let's go to Jerusalem. Let's go to the upper room. Let's go to the Last Supper. And not to Milan. That's where you actually can see the painting if you want at the Last Supper. Let's actually go to the story of the Last Supper where Jesus and his 12 colleagues are preparing to eat the Passover meal together. And as they're there, the disciples again are arguing, as usual, about who's the greatest. They're sort of all like Muhammad Ali. Remember, he used to always say, I am the greatest. Well, they love to talk about which one's the greatest. And in Luke 22, in his version of the Last Supper, that's what they're arguing about. By the way, if you ever want to do an interesting study of the Last Supper, do a synoptic study. Read it from Matthew, a sort of four-dimensional picture of the Last Supper from all four of their perspectives. So there we are. They're arguing over who's the greatest, and there's Jesus at the table. Jesus is their rabbi. He is their Lord, and he's about to model real service, genuine servanthood. He's about to model it to these 12 guys. But in many ways, he's going to model it to this new community called the church, a model that will be remembered for thousands of years so that we even still remember it today. Jesus gets up from the table. He gets a basin full of water, and he washes all 12 of the disciples' feet. Here, listen as I read it. I'm going to read John 13 in the first 5 verses there. Before the Passover festival, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. There's tremendous pathos in that verse, by the way. Now, when it was time for supper, the devil had already put into the heart of Judas, Simon Iscariot's son, to betray him. Jesus knew that the Father had given him everything into his hands, that he had come from God, and that he was going back to God. So he got up from supper, laid aside his outer clothing, took a towel, and tied it around himself. Next, Jesus poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet and to dry them with the towel tied around him. So what's going on? What's happening now? Let me tell you, first of all, this isn't a religious ceremony that he's doing. This is actually a hospitality practice. It's what you do in your home when you have people into your home. Because you have to realize Israel is a very dusty place. And in Israel, it's always flip-flop season. You're always wearing your sandals. You're always wearing your flip-flops. So everybody's feet are pretty stinky. They're pretty dirty. And so when you have somebody into your home, part of the hospitality practice, not unlike here in January, when you have a bunch of people over to your house and somebody collects all the coats, you know that, and you end up stacking them, you know, 10 feet high on the guest bed. Similar, very similar practice. This is a lot more gross of a practice than just collecting coats, but this was practiced in homes. Somebody would come to your home and then their feet would be washed. It was often a demeaning task, usually not done by the owner of the home. He usually had somebody, a servant, that basically did that disgusting task of washing everybody's feet. Now, what we have to remember is Jesus and his 12 friends are in the upper room. They don't own it. They had to rent it. One of them went on Airbnb and they found this one and they said, that looks like a good room. And they went to that room. So they don't own it. There's no owner. There's no servant to wash feet. So who's going to wash feet? Well, you can pretty much bet that none of these Muhammad Ali wannabes who are the greatest are going to get up and wash anybody's feet. No. They're too busy jockeying for position in the kingdom. They're going to be the leader. Not a one of them are going to lift a drop of water. So Jesus, their teacher, their leader, and I find this interesting, instead of getting ticked at them, which I probably would have done, or disappointed or frustrated, Jesus instead gets up, disrobes, all around his waist, and begins washing 12 sets of feet. Imagine how disgusting that towel and that water must have been when he was all done. 12 sets of feet. That's 120 toes he was washing. Whoa. Now, it's interesting. Jesus didn't say, well, since none of you are going to do it, I guess I'll have to do it. Oh, no. There was no identity crisis in Jesus. We heard it in the text. He knew who he was. He knew who he was, and he knew why he was here. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And he washed. Interesting, right in the middle of this passage is a little story, kind of an aside. It's a story about Peter. Now, Peter, if you know, is the one apostle that there's no filter between his brain and his mouth. And so as Jesus is washing all the disciples' feet, Peter says, never, meaning you're not touching these toes, never. To which Jesus then said, if I don't wash you, you will have no part in me. Take the meaning up a level. And Jesus is basically saying, if there's any sense in us where we say, I don't need Jesus's work or his washing in my life, I'm done. I'm finished. And Peter heard that. And Peter, in his Peter way, then said, okay, I got it. Then wash all of me, not just my feet. Wash me from head to toe. To which Jesus was used to that kind of reply, could just say, no, settle down. All I need to do is your feet. So Jesus washes his feet and the other 11. He said, washed their feet and put on his outer clothing. He sat back down again. And I would love to be there because the disciples must have been like, I didn't see that coming. That was crazy. What was that all about? Well, then here comes the teachable moment. Middle of 12. Jesus says to them, you don't know what I've done for you. No, I thought you washed my feet. You call me teacher and Lord, and you are speaking rightly, since that is what I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought also wash my feet. No, he doesn't say that. Since I, your teacher and Lord, have washed your feet, then you must never let them get dirty again. He didn't say that either. He says, since I have washed your feet, you ought also to wash one another's feet. I've given you this example, and you should do what I have done for you. You should wash one another's feet. You think, that's not very glamorous, is it? The other callings of discipleship are a bit more daring or a bit more macho than that one. You know, if you're to be my disciple, you are to pick up your cross and follow me. Okay, I can do that. That sounds macho. I'm going to pick up my cross. I'm going to follow. This is hard work. Let's go. Let's do it. Or if you're going to be my disciple, then you have to hate the other relationships that are closest to you. And you think, ooh, okay, we can do that. That sounds like confrontation. That sounds like conflict. Maybe even martyrdom, but let's go. That's macho. Let's do it. So everyone will know what I stand for and what I stand up to. That's me, okay? Let's do it. But wash people's feet? That's so mundane. That's so ordinary. That's so unnoticeable. I mean, where's the status in that? For these guys who are so interested in power and being the greatest, Jesus shuts off the spotlight. Jesus flattens the organizational chart. And Jesus pretty much just says, Christian leadership, Christian greatness can be summed up in a flimsy towel and a stinky basin. You want some of that? To be deeply spiritual, to be truly Christ-like, must be a servant of others in the rhythm of service. In Jesus' name. Jesus couldn't have been any clearer. If I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, then you ought to also wash one another's feet. I've given you the example. Go do it. I want us to look at some of the implications of that for our lives. I want to end with a bit of time looking at this rhythm of service and actually what it looks like or what it could look like. I just got three ideas to throw at you. The rhythm of service has to include mimicking the humble love of Christ. Don't miss the humility of washing somebody's feet, especially those that would be your inferiors. I mean, that was Peter's problem. You're not washing my feet. He elevated Christ and elevated ministry so high. Jesus, you're too important for washing feet. You're too dignified. And in a sense, also saying, and therefore I am too. What he missed was, this was Jesus' entire MO. His whole life was a life of service. And so when he donned a robe, he didn't don the robe of a king. He donned the robe of a servant. The rhythm of service has to include mimicking the humble love of Christ. Isaiah would talk about Messiah, and then it would be quoted again in the Gospels. And it would say that the Messiah would not break a bruised reed or snuff out a smoldering wick. The Messiah would not break a bruised reed, just think of a reed, of a plant, or snuff out a smoldering wick. What's he saying? He's saying Messiah knows how fragile everybody is, and it will never be beneath serve and be kind to those with needs. I mean, his humility. On Palm Sunday, everyone expected Messiah to come on a white steed. No. On a rented mule. One of our favorite Mexican restaurants that Sue and I go to in Stowe, down near Akron. El Campesino is the name. And the owner is a fellow that's a great business owner. He owns a bunch of restaurants and does a really good job in leading them. And it's not unusual to drive in one day, on a nice day especially, and there he is mowing the grass. Jamie, you're the owner of this thing, or shoveling the walks in the snow. It's not unusual for you to be there and after the waiter has taken your order or you're done eating, to go over there and you see him, he's bussing the tables. Why are you doing that? You're the owner of this thing. Because he understands that. It's not beneath him to do any of those things. That is what a Christ follower knows. Let me boast on our staff just for a minute. For years now, we've had a really faithful janitor who has done a great job keeping this place really, really clean, especially even during COVID, keeping this place very clean for us. A couple of months ago, he was in a very serious car accident. So much so that he's still in physical therapy and cannot work. Here's the boast for the staff. The last several weeks, it would not be unusual if you came on a Thursday that you would see pastors and ministry leaders scrubbing toilets, mopping floors, getting this place spick and span clean for Sunday. And from a distance, you'd say, wait a minute, pastors shouldn't scrub toilets. Oh, but you'll see David or Ty doing it. Why? Wilkin was the president of Columbia School of the Bible and Seminary. Brilliant man, PhD, powerful president of this school. He was married to his wife Muriel for 42 years. Muriel began developing symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And as he would describe it, little by little, she would remember fewer and fewer people. She always recognized him and the family. He lived at home with her, even as it got a bit worse. She would get really fearful when he would leave the house to go to the school, which was just a mile or so down the road. She would get so fearful that she would go looking for him. And she would walk that mile or so, walk to Columbia School. And sometimes she'd get lost, but she would try to find her way because she needed to find him. As she got a little bit worse, he would have to help her get dressed, including putting on her socks and shoes. And he noticed one time as he was putting her socks and shoes on that she had tremendous blisters and her feet were all bloody because she was walking way too much. This powerful PhD president of a school realized he had to make a decision. And in some ways, to everyone's surprise, he wrote a letter of resignation to the school saying, this season of my life, God has called me no longer to be the powerful president of Columbia, but to be the loving husband of my wife. Here's what he writes. Recently, it's become apparent that Muriel is contented most of the time when she is with me and almost none of the time that I am away from her. It is not just discontent. She is filled with fear that she has lost me and always goes in search of me when I leave home. So it is clear to me that she needs me now, full time. The decision was, and until death do us part. So as I told the students and the faculty, as a man of my word, integrity has something to do with it. But so does fairness. She has cared for me fully and sacrificially all these years. If I cared for her for the next 40 years, I still would not be out of her debt. Duty, however, can be grim and stoic, but there's more. I love Muriel. She's a delight to me. Her childlike dependence now and confidence in me, her warm love and occasional flashes of that wit I used to relish so, her happy spirit and tough resilience in the face of her continual distressing frustration. I don't have to care for her. I get to. It is a high honor to care for someone so wonderful. That's that. That's mimicking the love of Christ, the humble love of Christ. A guy with all the power of two schools and a PhD says, I'm done. I'm going to serve my wife. But there's a second aspect of the rhythm of service, and I call it maturing to see the needs of others. Maturing to see the needs of others. And in many ways, the immature disciples, who not a one of them would lift a finger to wash anybody's feet, didn't see that yet, but they would. And those 11 guys would spend their lives washing the feet of the world with their lives, with their words, so much so that their service not only led to 10 of their martyrdoms, but in many ways established the character of the Christian church, which for 2,000 years is symbolic to servanthood. It's those guys that finally learned it. They finally matured to the point of understanding that that's what Christianity is all about. It's seeing the needs of others. You know how you know your kids are growing up a little bit? They're able to look past their own needs, and they're able to see the needs of others. Maybe their grandmother. Maybe their siblings. When our daughter Sarah was little, I think she was about 7, we would take that ministry group, we call them the Young Professionals, and at Christmas time, we would go to Children's Hospital in Akron. And you know, at Christmas time, boy, they discharge just about every patient they can, but that's the sickest ones that are still there. But we would go and we would sing carols to the children at Children's Hospital, and we would buy presents for them. And a few days beforehand, we would take little Sarah and we would go to, you know, Toys R Us or one of those stores, and we would let her pick out a few presents to give to the kids in the hospital. And boy, she would do it. She took it seriously, and she would pick some of her favorite stuffed animals or her favorite toys that we knew she loved. We knew she was mature. She was the first one to give them to the kids. That's what maturity is. Maturity is coming to the place where I can see past myself, past my life, and I see you, and I see others. And in many ways, we've been at Trinity now, 5.5 years? In many ways, Trinity can be very, very Christ-like in the way we serve and in the way we care for others, whether it's caring for others in our own fellowship or caring for our friends all over the world, whether in Lake County or in India or China. A fellowship shows its maturity in the way it sees the needs of others and jumps to serve them, to wash their feet. Well, there's a third rhythm of service. And I struggle with this phrasing because it sounds funny, but I couldn't come up with anything better. Mattering to the world weary. Well, first of all, I looked it up. Mattering is a word. Okay, so don't call me on that. Mattering to the world weary, simply meaning we do the things that matter. And the world weary, if the dirty feet are a symbol of anything, they are a symbol of the world weary, where the world never stops beating people up, where relentlessly the world, everywhere, out there, forever, forever, people are weary. They are world weary. And we serve others because it matters. Because it matters to them. We don't serve others simply because we're told to, or simply because we'll get the applause or the newspaper headlines, or even because it makes our hearts feel so good, even though it does. We serve others because it really matters to them. It actually makes a difference. And I could use some of you as stories, or Mother Teresa to go the other end, doing the things that matter. And then not just the action, but the people. You focus on the people. I had a friend, his name is Larry. He works at the post office. He's a mail deliverer. And Larry used to be in one of my small groups. And one time as we were talking in the small group, we were discussing the Christian ethic of work and how followers of Christ must be the hardest workers. They must work unto the Lord. They must work with integrity. They must do work really well. They must excel in work. And after we all talked about how we're the greatest, I mean, we're just like the apostles. Oh, yes. Got quiet. And then Larry said, I'm a lousy mailman. What? I'm a lousy. Oh, Larry, you can't be a lousy. You got a testimony. You got a whole. No, I'm a lousy. What do you mean you're lousy? And he described Larry had a rural route in Portage County. And he said, and they give us an allotted time to do our route. And I'm always late. I'm always way late. Well, Larry, you can't be late, man. You got to do your job. Let's go. If you're so far apart, they don't even see each other. And so I'll pull up to Mrs. Williams' house and I'll walk up and I'll give her her mail and she'll have a pot of coffee ready for me. And we'll sit down and she'll talk about her grandson in Columbus and how he's a special needs child. And man, well, I'll just let her talk. Finish my coffee, get back in my truck, go to the next house. It's Mr. Jones, and I give Mr. Jones his package, and what's the matter? And he'll talk about how he lost his job and how he's struggling. And he said, I can't just leave him, so I listen to him. And he says, and I go to house, and it's all the same way. And it just ends up with, I'm way late, and I get written up for being late. I looked at Larry, and I said, you're the best mailman I've ever met in my life. Mattering to the world weary. That's our calling. That's what the Lord calls all of us to do. In many ways, service is the epitome of the rhythms of the spiritual life because it is in serving we are the most Christ-like. I'm going to show you a chart as I begin to finish up here. You're going to see it all year long. Serving is not a program. Serving needs to be a personality. And it'll be a personality for Trinity for this year and forever. At least as long as I'm here. We've talked at the very beginning, we talked about blessing the city. Those are just five areas that we have very specific things right now that maybe you or your small group will say, hey, we want some of that. There's going to be a whole bunch more. And you have ideas as well. I know there's someone in our church that's still making masks for people that need masks. You've got ideas too. This is a sample of ideas of doing ministry. There will be much more where we can serve. We can bless our community. We can bless our city. Visit trinitymentor.com, bless the city, and you'll see the specifics for those. And in time, more and more. And you're going to hear this again and again. Here's our goal from now until New Year's Eve. 1,000 hours of service. 1,000 hours of service church-wide. So your small group of five decide you're going to go do something at Hannah's home. You spend 2 hours doing something, that's 10 hours of service. So you go back to that thing on our website, you log in and you say, okay, we did 10 hours. And you're going to see it all year long, not to get applause, but just to develop the rhythm that this is what we do as a church. And if I know Trinity, our goal is 1,000 service hours. I bet by December, we've got 3,000, because that's what we do. In many ways, the most Christ-like rhythm of them all is the rhythm of service. You're going to hear about this again and again and again. And so I end with this. Keep it up. I feel like the owner of the gym that's telling you, keep running your laps, keep doing the Nautilus, keep riding your bike. Remember, you never graduate from the school of spiritual formation. It's something that needs to be part of our lives forever. Jesus said, I came not to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many. And the ransom is his cross. And that cross is our motivation to serve as Christ did. Would you pray with me, please? Father, I do pray for my friends in this room. And I pray, Father, that we would get to the point, not out of duty, but out of heart change, that we would long to serve you in our own style, in our own way, but that we would be known as people of the smelly towel, of the stinky basin, that we would be people that serve, that wash feet. In Jesus' name I pray.